Hello, Red Spotters. Welcome to another episode of To The Table, where two people review a movie that one another has never seen, and we bring a movie to the table, so to speak. Joining me today is Alexis Soto. How are you doing today, Alexis?
I am doing so well. It's actually good to be back on this show. It's been quite some time since you and I have done one of these together, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been a really long time after the... What did we do last?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Wasn't it Face Off?
Oh my god. Was it?
I think that's... Yeah.
Wow.
That's the last time we did one. Face Off. Wow. Well, today, we're gonna face off today. We have two completely contradicting movies in terms of, like, theme.
They're just different movies in general, like way different,
but it's just something that both you and I haven't seen before. Alexis gave me a movie called All the President's Men, and I gave him there's an interesting story about the movie that I gave him, and it's a Rocky Horror Picture Show. But there's an interesting way in which he saw it, and I want to save that for last. I want to spend more time on that, because I want to hear your insight on the thing. And now that the movie has aged on you, I want to know what you think about it. Will that be cool with you, Mr. Soto?
Yeah, whatever you want, Kyle.
Okay, so I'm gonna go into All the President's Men first. Mm-hmm. Alexis, why did you give me this movie?
Well, I gave you this movie because it seems that you really liked The Post, and you're very much intrigued with that era and the story that was going on there. And as we know, that movie kind of ends off with teasing Watergate. And so I think...
And the movie starts off with Watergate.
Exactly, right? So it's like...
It's kind of like Rogue One.
Yeah.
Star Wars kind of thing.
Exactly. So that's why I thought that might as well just give this movie to you now, because it's a movie you haven't seen. But it's also... It involves a story that you're interested in, and I think you want answers on. And I thought it was a good movie, too. I only recently saw the movie, like, I think late last year. So it's not like I've known this for, like, a super, super long time. But this is a 70s movie with Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
And it obviously, it deals with the... adventure, well, not so much an adventure, but what they went through. Basically, this is the Washington Post and the two famous reporters, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, who are assigned to basically solve Watergate. And as we all know, this led to the downfall of a president. And like The Post, it's eerily relevant to what is happening in our own time. So I thought
it's so funny how stuff from the 70s is like very interconnected with what's going on in 2018 and everything like that. What can I say about this movie? It's a very, very interesting kind of thing. First and foremost, I have to say that Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman's acting is amazing and superb. Like their acting style, like, you know how you watch like movies of the 70s and the 80s, and you could definitely tell the acting is of that that year or that decade.
Yeah.
their performance ages perfectly. Like, the way that they perform their characters is very real, and it feels like something that would be performed today.
It's a 70s movie, but it feels like it was made today.
And, yeah. And I think... And that's very special. That's very unique, because I see a lot of, like, movies of, like, different decades, and it's very catered to that decade. There are some acting choices from other actors that I could tell that is from that era. Specifically, the guy who plays Ben Bradley.
Yes.
He is definitely like, let me tell you about this, people, and... very stereotypical Bostonian accent, and it's like very thick, very exaggerated, and that's where you can compare and contrast Tom Hanks' performance as Ben Bradley. His was more subtle, and that's where you get like, okay, gotta get into all that stuff. But overall, I got the gist of what it was trying to do, and what it tried to do, it did, and it did it really good. I like how the movie first the movie opens kind of with like a jump scare with the impounding sounds of a typewriter, and that right there, I was like, okay, what am I watching? A white screen? Because you know, if a movie is trying to be profound, it starts with a white screen and then it fades into the actual image. I thought it was going to do that, but no, it was like the impounding sounds of a typewriter. And that was really cool. That was a really cool effect. And you hear the goo, and then you saw the headlines on that. And then you see all that stuff, and it was really cool seeing. I thought a lot of the visual imagery was pretty good. I like how they use a lot of like the natural lighting of the thing. Like, for example, the offices, they didn't use a lot of stage lighting or anything. It was just all natural, and that was a nice little thing. And I think that was a nice added touch. This movie added like a layer of realism that I really appreciated about it.
Yeah.
And seeing everything unfold from like all the riddles that Deep Throat was given, and all the political, like how nobody wanted to talk, nobody wanted to speak, and how Nixon pretty much silenced all these people. It's pretty scary that leader of the free world is not very freeing. no relevant topic there. I really enjoyed it. That's what I could take away from it. Do you have any questions for me about how you?
Well, I mean, just to back you up on some just general comments about the film, and a couple of things to point out about it that I agree with you is the performances are terrific, and the shots that the director chose were very important. I do think that. There is this level of realism that I think helps to propel the importance of this movie even further. But I think for me, what is the biggest takeaway from the movie is, you know, Watergate was a very complicated beast. And I think what was important for this movie to establish and to, like, do a home run is to, like, present the base level facts that everybody knows about the Watergate break-in, and then use that as a staging ground to slowly unravel the big mystery, because it's like we are looking at the events of history, and obviously no one really knew aside from the president about the cover-up, right? About the break-in. And you see the reactions and the shock as Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman slowly but surely find...
Uncover?
Right, they're uncovering what's actually there. And I think where the movie really excels is the big reveals and the journey to get there. Because obviously these reporters really had to bend over backwards, literally, to get these kind of reveals. And you're talking about
a time. Yeah, because nobody was willing to talk.
No one was willing to talk. On top of the fact that this was the late 60s, early 70s era, where communication and technology is not what it is today. It's not easily as accessible. It's just so much more difficult, right? And
yeah, like they were going house to house.
Mm-hmm. They were going house to house and looking at different people. But when you notice that when they meet somebody new, they're so terrified. And there are several instances where they literally fear for their lives. Like they know that they're being watched. And
yeah,
go ahead.
Like I love this one scene where Robert Redford, after a Deep Throat tells them that of the surveillance stuff that's going on, and I love like almost like panicked, paranoid kind of way that Robert Redford's character presented himself. And he went to Dustin Hoffman's place for a bit, and he was like, I can't speak. Like he was trying to like mime that. And then he went to the typewriter, and I like how they like started messaging with the typewriter. It's kind of like the modern day, like put something on your notepad from on your iPhone, and then pass it on to the person next to you. It's kind of like the equivalent, but except they had to have it on a typewriter. And I found that really cool. I found like little details like that really, really interesting. And the ways that that they worked with what they had back then, like there were like really long long takes of them just trying to punch in a number on the phone, and because they have the spinning wheels on the telephones to contact the number, and the long takes that it would do to get that. It kind of added a level of tension, kind of like,
yeah,
my god, I hope that they get the information, because it took them a while to just get like a single person on the line, and that right there is like very eye opening, and you're like, journalism today is kind of a walk in the, well, not a walk in the park, because there's a president who's trying to destroy that today, but
and who also supports a regime that murders journalists. We should put that down.
Yeah, and so it's kind of daunting or tasking, whatever adjective
fits. Intimidating.
Describes it of how they the frustration. You feel the frustration in every single number that they punch. That really struck me. I'm like, when I was watching, I don't know. It's just something about that scene of Robert Redford trying to punch in the numbers, and that right there is like, I'm frustrated for you. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's good writing, good acting, or good cinematography.
I think it's great. I think it's great filmmaking, and I want to add on what you were saying, because I think that there are many moments throughout the movie that are really added in with a lot of tension and suspense. One scene that sticks out to me is in one of those sequences where Robert Redford, who plays Bob Woodward, is talking to Deep Throat in their usual meetup place. And then they hear a noise, and they both freak out. And the minute that Robert Redford turns around, Deep Throat is gone, and he's just literally just backing away. And then he's just running and running because he feels that there's somebody behind him following him. And I think it adds just this extra layer to think that the journalists themselves, the reporters themselves, are now being watched the same as the people who know about the cover-up. I thought that was a genuinely terrifying sequence. That was pretty creepy as hell.
Yeah. I just thought that this movie was a well shot.
Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this question about to get into the, you know, the content about the scandal of Watergate. Did anything in this movie reinforce what you thought about Watergate? Did it like make it seem worse than you remember it being? And the legacy of Richard Nixon. And then, of course, at the end of that, how it feels similar to where we are now.
The thing that I took away from it is that I knew that Watergate was shitty. I knew that from the get-go. I knew how deep this whole situation was, and how long the stream went, but I did not. The thing that I appreciate more about what journalists did at the time was how much endangered a lot of these journalists were, and how many people were terrified. I got the fact that, you know, Nixon did everything he could to try and cover his tracks and all that shit. But the thing that I failed to realize was how many people's lives were at stake, and that's a no good thing. You know, that's not good. And that's what made the situation more real and more not mundane. It's not mundane. I'm trying to think of an adjective.
Well, I just think it was terrifying that you had a situation in real life where the president was striking fear into the very lives of many Americans who had any information about this Watergate thing. It felt like people who were in fear of a dictator. And some people think that Richard Nixon carried himself in that way, especially. And you see when they use Richard Nixon in The Post, because in The Post, which is the events that precede the Watergate scandal with the Pentagon Papers, he is portrayed as being very antagonistic toward the newspapers because of the words they print about him, and because of the leaking of government secrets, so much so to the point where he actively seeks to discredit the newspapers and essentially considers them his personal enemy.
And what I find more striking is the second to final image of the movie, because the movie ends with the same typewriter typing away all the future headlines following up Nixon's impeachment or resignation. And the second to the last image that really struck me was Robert Redford, Dustin Hoffman versus Richard Nixon, and there was a shot of a TV, and it's in the Washington Post room, the main floor, and off in the distance is Robert Redford and Dustin typing away and working on the next article immediately, and them just the sound of the typewriter and the sound of hearing the second term inauguration of Richard Nixon. That right there is a really striking image. Just seeing, you know, it's a vision, it's a symbolism, if you will. Just seeing the journalists versus Richard Nixon, and just seeing that all in one shot. And it was a really long take, and you really felt that kind of importance with that, and you definitely felt compelled with what they were doing. You know, do you remember what shot I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, I know exactly, and you're right. I agree with every word you're saying.
Yeah, and so right there, you definitely felt the need and importance of what they were doing, and that right there is one of my favorite shots from the film. It's,
yeah, I agree.
It's the TV going off and then the inauguration and the journalists just working and typing away, trying to dethrone this man, you know.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you cannot go like the Septa Baylor, but
yeah, well, we don't know. I actually wanted to
comment. But no, that's a complete burn on American democracy, which we are against, ladies and gentlemen. We are against the burning of American democracy. We stand for everything that is democracy here in Red Spotlight Entertainment.
I actually wanted to comment on the state of affairs in which the world that you and I live in, Kyle, in 2018 are very much almost like a parallel to what's happening with Watergate.
If not the same.
With Watergate. But I think the difference here is that it's happening out in the open more than what in Watergate, where it was behind the scenes, because as we're speaking, at this very moment in time, the president of the United States had already fired the director of the FBI because he wanted to impede and conclude the Russia investigation into collusion and, of course, separate investigation to obstruction of justice. And then recently, as this week, he fired the deputy director and it's beginning to look as if he is literally knocking everyone off in his way to the special counsel, Bob Mueller, who is in charge of this investigation, who at this point, by the way, an investigation that has already criminally indicted at least three people associated with the president. Former campaign manager, former national security advisor, former campaign advisor. These are some pretty high-profile people that have already been arrested and criminally indicted. So we're watching this unfold before our eyes, and just this week, the president is kicking it into high gear by enlisting the help of the grand old party, the GOP, in... They were literally planning this week on releasing a smear campaign on Bob Mueller by releasing a memo that was written in the fifth dimension, this alternative reality, just to create disinformation and distrust within the FBI. You're seeing here a president and his political party united.
Trying to destroy the infrastructure.
They're trying to destroy America by discrediting the Federal Intelligence Bureau. I mean, the Federal Bureau of Intelligence, the FBI. They're trying to torch down the place just to protect the president. Because they also announced this week, by the way, that the Republican Party in the House is opening an investigation into the FBI. They're going to relitigate whether or not the FBI's investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails was mishandled, because why the hell not? And also, you have the Speaker of the House saying this week that the FBI itself needs to be cleansed. You have other senators who are seriously considering the fact that that a secret society may exist within the FBI, like a Hydra society that exists to take down President Trump. This is serious.
The Illuminati exists.
And, you know, this sounds like it's made for a movie, right? But this is real life, and it's getting kind of scary because like, we're talking about a movie that happened, right? All the President's Men dictate, like, is a real event, but...
I have a question for you. Does Donald Trump think that out of nowhere, Nicolas Cage is going to come out of the corner and surprise everybody?
Well, that's the thing, though. Tonight he gave a State of the Union, and he is a master of distraction. All he does is distract the American people and everybody around the world with literally anything. When any time the news, and you watch this, any time the news is focusing way too much on Russia, he always finds a way to distract from that. Because at the end of the day, you and I believe that there is so much there that is illegal and corrupt. And whether or not President Trump himself is guilty of collusion, I think several people in his campaign will be found guilty of collusion. And the president himself may be charged with obstruction of justice, because what does obstruction of justice means? He is trying to destroy an investigation into himself. The FBI is investigating him, and he is actively trying to shut that down. That is illegal. That is treason. And you have a president who is acting and behaving like the last president who tried to take on a similar battle and ended up losing his presidency because of it. He would have been impeached and arrested if he hadn't resigned and been pardoned by Gerry Ford. So I think the importance of this movie... excuse me. Trump's speech
is... Take your time.
Trump's speech really took a toll on me. You see the events of what happened in this movie, and it feels like it's just... it's playing out in real time in our lives, and I just think this and The Post make for a hell of a double feature, but a hell of a sucker punch into... and a real eye-opening... double feature to show you that how much things haven't really changed to here we are again with another president who is discrediting also the media. By the way, I've talked about him trying to destroy the FBI. He began his presidency by labeling media fake news. We're living in the era of fake news. And yeah, we say it all the time on this podcast as a joke, like, oh, you're fake news and everything. But it's a serious accusation to label the media as fake news. You're creating seeds of mistrust. And the president, this president, more so than Richard Nixon, is more focused on spreading his own kind of propaganda. And it really terrifies me as a concerned citizen of this nation where he plans on taking this, because he is leading a cult of personality. And I just think with the films that we have discussed here, they're important because of real life. And it shows you why these kind of films do matter, that we need to reevaluate and to consider these things. And it also shows you how educational films can be. So, and it's also a hell of a good movie, I would say, All the President's Men. And I'm happy you enjoyed it.
Yeah. IGN, 10 out of 10.
But there was no fish penis, though. 2 out of 10.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. No Doug Jones either. So yeah. That's a debunk. Or no Michael Shannon.
There was no Stan Lee either.
No Excelsior. Alexis.
Yes.
For your film, you watched it quite interestingly.
Well, you need to describe what the hell that was I attended.
So, I had a... So, for a long time, I've been like, Alexis, you gotta watch Rocky Horror Picture Show. And of course, reluctantly, unless it has political intrigue, or Oscar, or box office potency... He refuses to watch anything outside of those three categories.
Except that's so, not true, because we've done a show called To the Table where I have seen films that you and Peter had recommended I've seen.
Reluctantly, But yes.
It doesn't matter. I've done it. I've kept at my end of the bargain, and I'm very thankful for all of the films that I've been able to experience, including this one. So that's a little tease of what's to come.
So I had you watch Rocky Horror Picture Show, one of my personal favorite movies. And ironically, Peter, I really enjoy the movie.
Well, I think you need to get into the history of this movie.
And this movie was a cult classic.
It is a cult classic.
At first, it didn't do well. At first, it didn't do well in the theaters. And ironically, it is the longest running movie in.
Because it's still playing in theaters.
To have a theatrical run. And to qualify for that, every weekend, every week, a movie has to be playing. Your movie has to be playing in order to make that that qualification of longest running of theatrical run cinema release movie. And that's a qualification. And there's this group along with the movie, many groups who riff, act, and make pretty much interact with the film along with the audience, and it is a tradition of this movie to do that. And this level of interactivity with these different fan groups all over the globe do this, specifically here in the U.S. The U.S. has a lot of love for Rocky Horror Picture Show. Rocky Horror Picture Show made the following two names a household name, Susan Sarandon and Tim Curry. And those movies really become a staple in not only musical cinema, but also it added a level of grotesque that made it okay for movies of this caliber to be made, and for just downright bonkeredness to be made. And so I was like, I want Alexis Soto, Alexis J. Soto, to be introduced into this madness. And what a hell of a way to be introduced to the madness. Alexis, first I'm going to ask you two questions, and you could follow it up one after the other. Explain to me your first time seeing it with the interactive part, because you didn't just see it straight up. You saw it with the interactive part. We saw it in the Kent Theater in San Diego, and his first experience was the interactive experience. And I'm not sure if you went back and watched the movie.
No, you didn't have.
Yeah, I have to, but you got to experience the interactivity first. I'm quite jealous, actually. Well, yeah, maybe jealous, because what a hell of a way to be introduced to Rocky Horror Picture Show. I mean, you really were introduced to it with a bang. And I want to know what your thoughts were being introduced to it in such a non-traditional way. Mr. Soto, take it away.
Well, first I'd like to thank our good friends Nettie Valdez and Eric Wong for inviting us to attend this event.
Yes.
Because
shout outs to them.
If it weren't for them, we probably wouldn't have actually gone out and done this.
Or even heard about it.
Yeah.
Or known that this stuff was happening. I knew about this stuff happening, but I didn't know that it was. I had the opportunity to go see it. So thank you, Nettie, for calling me and saying, "Hey, this thing is going down." So anyway, continue, Mr. Soto.
Yeah. So, all right. Obviously, with this, they're. Because this wasn't just a regular thing where I saw the movie on my own. This was an added cinematic experience Number one, because we actually went to a movie theater and we saw this play on the big screen. My first time seeing it on the big screen. But what also added...
Quite jealous, Mr. Soto.
What also added to what was happening, with this event that took place, it's not just that you're watching this particular film. And you basically have a sideshow going on around you, like fucking surround sound, riffing with the movie, like a comedy club, basically. And just like telling jokes and one-liners and gags and a whole bunch of elaborate orchestrations along with people on stage, lip-syncing and costumes
in
and everything.
In costumes. Right. Yeah.
They're doing everything with the pace of the film. And that in itself is an added experience that you just couldn't get when you're just watching the movie. And I have to say that, look, I know Kyle has been trying to get me to watch this movie for so many years. There's a reason I stay the hell away from it, because it looks like a complete crackpot case for weirdos. And that's not meant as a disparaging comment. But clearly this isn't a movie anywhere anybody would accuse me of being up my alley. This is entirely a film that Kyle would love, because that's not meant in any kind of light. That's just that Kyle likes those kinds of movies that are really out there and artistic and just weird and fun. And those are the kinds of movies that for the greater part of my life, I've gravitated away from entirely, because they just look like weird and stupid and a complete waste of time. And I'm actually very much grateful that I had the opportunity to see this for the very first time with a group of huge, huge fans who not only put on the added production, but also with a full audience of fans of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, including Kyle. Kyle was hollering and on his feet and applauding and yelling and laughing with so much of what was happening. And I will get into any particulars that I heard about the live experience toward the latter half of the conversation. I actually want to focus right now on the movie. But I do think it really made the movie hold up better, watching it on the big screen and then also seeing this adoration for it, this level of respect for it and love, because I don't know if I would have liked it as much as I really did if I had just seen it on my laptop, because
by itself.
Yeah, by itself, because like this is a really weird fucking movie. No, seriously.
Don't say.
This is the weirdest shit I've seen ever. Like, by the way, like, Kyle had shown me various and multiple occasions of Tim Curry's performance as, what's the character's name?
Dr. Frankenfurter.
Of course. Dr. Frankenfurter, the musical number I'm a Sweet Transvestite, I had the great pleasure of being introduced to that years before I had even seen the fucking movie, which, by the way, I'm not sure that helped in gunning my interest for the movie initially. I don't think it did. Not that I thought little of it. It's just that, okay. I'm a Sweet Transvestite. I mean, that
it's a great freaking number. Don't deny it.
It's a weird fucking thing, because apparently at the very end it was revealed that that these people were aliens from a place called Transylvania, in which they're a very sexualized culture. And
it's from the galaxy Transylvania, from the planet Transsexual.
Okay. Okay. Well, you see, that is something that came out of left field, but really kind of makes the most sense, if anything in this movie came to making sense, which is so weird because it just happens at the last possible moment to establish, oh, these people are actually aliens.
Like, it's like, oh, they just dropped the information. Oh, by the way, guys, these guys are aliens, just so you know.
Because, like, okay, so this starts off with Susan Sarandon, and I guess his name is Brad, the character. They're off after a wedding, and they're engaged, I think, and they're, like, the stereotypical American conservative young couple. And in the 70s, right, when this came out, and they're stuck off the side of the road in the middle of a storm, and they go into this creepy, haunted place. And oh my God, I don't know what the hell they were expecting, but that was not it. You look, from the moment they step into that mansion, it is just a parade of the most inconceivable and and baffling.
You lost for words.
No, it is a parade of the most inconceivable and baffling group of sequences I think I have ever seen. Because it's basically from the minute they get into it, these are these weirdos that are just singing and dancing. And, you know, singing and dancing in the music. I guess this is considered a musical, right? Yes.
Yeah, it is a musical.
Yeah, it's a musical, and it's like, yeah, that's not normally what's weird, but it's just how these people act. That's just, at some point, it gets to be kind of terrifying with how they're dressed and how they look and the things that they can do. And, I mean, really, the couple, they're just there to call somebody for help, and they just get swept up in this... Excuse me. They get swept up in this.
It's kind of like this weird macabre storm, yeah, that they get involved in.
I mean, yeah. I mean, they literally they go into the mansion. Then it's like, let's do the time warp, and then I'm a sweet transvestite, and then they go underground, and then the transvestite brings life to this Adonis in a bubble bath. And then out of nowhere, this biker dude crashes into the place. He gets...
played gloriously by Meatloaf.
He gets this fantastical musical number until the sweet transvestite murders him with an axe. And then we're just... okay, and then we move on to...
Do you know why? Do you know why he...
hold on. We'll get to that. I don't, first of all, so I don't know. I really have no idea what the point of that sequence was, to tell you the truth. We'll get to that later. And then it walks into Tim Curry having sex with the Adonis, and then having sex with Susan Sarandon, and then having sex with Brad, which were honestly entertaining sequences. And then, really, I mean, you get your pay grade there. And then we go into this excuse of a dinner, and then we get betrayals of...
And then they're eating the biker dude.
Yeah, we get betrayals, and then... Yeah, like, this movie is just... It's like... It's bonkers. It's like, all the while, it's being narrated by this old dude. It's like, where the hell is this thing going?
The criminologist is played amazingly by Charles Gray. And for those who know Charles Gray, and those who know me specifically, know that he portrayed Ernst Stravo Blofeld in Diamonds Are Forever, James Bond movie. So I really like his role. And when they did the revival, when Fox did the revival on a Rocky Horror Picture Show, Tim Curry played his role. So I found that that was the only thing I was like, yes, I completely am with that 100% in the when the Fox did the revival thing. So anyway, go on.
Yeah. What I think the movie excels is clearly in creativity. I mean, shit. I don't think anybody has anything on this movie as far as creativity is concerned. I mean, that's something I never would have thought of, really. I think some people may think that why was this even made? And honestly, there were times throughout the movie where I was thinking just that, is like, why? Like, really? I mean, not in a disparaging way, but just like okay.
We're going there.
Yeah. Well, not that we're going there, but like, oh, why? What was the reason why this was made? Like, you know, I usually try and find the meaning, the impertinence of the creation, but I have to say, I think really I enjoyed it for the mere crazy value. But when you peel away at the craziness, which isn't a bad thing, I don't consider it a bad thing. I'm not saying it as a bad way, but it is crazy. I think many fans would say that the craziness adds to the charm of this movie. But when you strip away the craziness, when you get down to it, you're left with some pretty stellar performances that, look, if this thing is weird, the actors really, really sold it. When it came to the acting as well as the singing. And I had no idea Tim Curry was that dynamic of a performer. I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, man. You have to see some of his other stuff. Like, his performance in The Three Musketeers is par none, man. I think it's just... Tim Curry's such a fascinating actor, and the way, the choices that he makes, the way that he like, oh, my finger will move this way instead of the other way, and somehow it'll make all the difference. And it does make all the difference. So that's such a great thing about Tim Curry and what he does. What else, Alexis?
The songs are pretty great. Hey, if musical is great, it has great songs, and I thought they were all pretty stellar. I mean, I don't know what the hell was going on with that Meatloaf thing, but it was a pretty cool song. I mean, seriously.
Bless my soul.
That's really what it comes down to. It is like, this movie alone is worth it just to see the performances and the songs. But yeah, I mean, I ended up liking it at the end of the day. I didn't think I would. But yeah, it's crazy, but hey, it's good.
Okay, so you don't know what Meatloaf was doing there in the musical, right?
I should stress that because, you know, we were in a theater, but there was a sideshow literally happening, so it is...
It had a hard time paying attention.
It had a hard time hearing, because we were in the back, you know? So
okay.
We had a hard time hearing exactly the context of what that was. I have no idea where that scene came from and what was even happening or what was the importance of that character.
Okay. We should take a part of the podcast, that way I could answer some of those issues you had. Okay. First, I'll take the whole Meatloaf issue as the first question. Now, notice how he created a guy, Rocky. Remember when he created Rocky, Dr. Frankenfurter? Remember that? Yes. Meatloaf was the prototype.
Really?
Dr. Frankenfurter made Meatloaf to be his ultimate sex slave.
Okay.
And And they were lovers at one point, but of course it's Meatloaf, and Meatloaf has to be rebellious and rock and roll and all that stuff, and he became like the ultimate like heartthrob amongst all the Transylvanians in the thing. Specifically, a the roadie, which is the one that's dressed in gold garb.
Right, right.
She became infatuated with them, and they fell in love. And he wasn't having that, so that's why he had Meatloaf murdered, because he's like, if I can't have him, nobody can have him, and he's like a jealous fit kind of thing. And so that's why he made Rocky. He made the new and improved sex slave kind of thing. And that's why you heard the wedding bells. I remember when you heard the wedding bells and they were going into that chamber with the really suggestive bed.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they were gonna do the dirty after his creation, and he made Rocky like perfect and for him, for Dr. Frankfurter, and that was the whole thing, is that he wanted to create the ultimate sex toy, sex boy or whatever. And that was the whole point of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes so much, that pretty much is the context for what I was missing. Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Okay, you have any more questions about the movie?
So this is like the 1970s, and it's depicting Dr. Frankenfurter fuck Brad.
Yeah.
Wow.
And not only that, but giving Brad head.
Wow.
And it's pretty funny. The neck, one of the neck shots in the movie is Janet looking at the screen and seeing Frankfurter laying there, and Brad having a cigarette after that. Like, he feels so dirty. Like, he's like, I gotta clean my soul kind of thing. And it's just really funny. It's just really funny seeing that. Anything else?
Not at the moment. You can pick it up from here.
Okay.
About the movie. Or did you want to go into the experience overall?
I want to say a few more things about the movie. I think the movie is perfectly structured. The structure in which, okay, we got to get from point A to B, and how they get there is amazing. Like, you get character development, you get introduction and to their world. You know, it's a great world building movie on a very low budget, and all the music is great, brilliantly written by Richard O'Brien, who played one of the characters in the movie and is Riff Raff, and he's the guy, bald guy in the movie.
Yes.
He's the writer and creator of this whole excursion, and I think that we have to give a huge applause to him because of what he did. He created a cultural phenomenon, and I think, I like how in the beginning of the whole thing, which we'll get to in a bit, the whole experience, when they were beginning the riffage. They said, in the name of the holy Richard O'Brien, amen. And I found that really intriguing. Like, oh, okay, yeah, it makes sense, because he did create this whole kind of culture and the way that this movie is, and it is regarded in like one of the best cinematic musicals of all time, and with the good reason. It is a really well made movie, and every year I pop it in. This was my fifth time watching the movie, seeing it with you, so I knew all this all the stuff, all the context and all that stuff. And once every 2 months, I find myself listening to the entirety of the soundtrack.
You find yourself doing the time warp yet again.
Yep, exactly. Let's do the time warp again. All right. So, Alexis,
hold on. One more thing before we transition to the experience. I want to ask you, what, if any, message do you think this movie has to say on the issue of sexuality?
These earthlings are not doing enough, man. They got to be sexier. That's why Riff Raff and Patricia killed Dr. Frankenfurter.
Yeah. Frankenfurter wasn't sexy enough.
No, that's why they killed him.
That's yeah. But I mean, in general, like, what do you think about this movie? Because it's very clear to me, based on having, you know, seen the fandom of this film in full force, that this has appealed to wide swaths of demographics around the world. And obviously a huge theme of the movie is sexuality. What, if any, like, commentary do you think the movie has to say about sexuality in general? Like, in terms, like, in our culture and society? Because this was the 70s, right? This is a time where sexuality that wasn't heterosexual wasn't accepted.
And not only that, but the subsequential decade after that was the whole big AIDS scare and fiasco,
which ravaged the LGBT community.
Yeah,
or I should say savaged even.
They had a huge target painted on their head unjustly. Mostly a lot of cases of the AIDS came from druggies sharing needles.
Yeah.
And
Woodstock, baby.
Yeah, groovy, baby. Yeah. I think the movie was centered on don't be so uptight, I guess.
Yeah.
Because be aware of all these things, because For Brad and Janet, their downfall was their naiveness of what was going on, and that was their eventual downfall. Them being naive on sexuality and all that, and them being afraid of everything sexual, got them where they were at the end. So because they were trying to, like, say, hey, it's okay. We do what we do, and that's what we do, you know. And them being naive about it really got them stuck in the end. Yeah. So that's what the message I got from it was.
Yeah, maybe people should. I mean, clearly the people who made this project in the 1970s knew that sexuality isn't a big deal and people should stop caring about it as much. Like, really, stop flipping out about sexuality, because, you know, I believe people are meant to experiment with sexuality, and whoever you identify it with is your choice and it's your life, and you shouldn't feel pressured into choosing one. And you certainly, I mean, if it's even an option, I mean, that's a whole debate in and of itself, but even then, you shouldn't be persecuted and attacked for being who you are. And that's, I think, in my book, an important underlying message to this movie. That, you know, it isn't that big of a deal, and it's certainly not a big enough deal to divide ourselves even further than we already are. So, that's my two cents.
Yeah. Okay, so speak to me about your experience.
Well, I think this would be a communal thing because, you know, you and I shared this experience together.
But the thing is that I knew about all this stuff going in, even though I've not experienced it. You came completely unaware of the extent of what was going on. You thought it was just going to be a performance piece, but it really wasn't. It was a full-on thing. I knew that a lot of people were going to be like throwing new toilet papers and like riffing throughout the whole movie and completely doing that. So I'll tell about my first experience with this, but I'm more interested, and I think our listeners are more interested in hearing what you have to say,
Mr. All two of them.
Well, maybe.
Maybe, if that.
We'll have to check the download counter on podcast.com.
Okay. I had an idea of an interactive piece, but what I got really just blew that out of the water. I mean, I certainly wasn't expecting it to be as intense as it was, because I mean there were certain areas in which the people who are running this production can get in your face about it, and it's definitely an experience that is tailor made for uber fans of this movie. But I was frankly just astounded by the absolute complexities and elaborate nature of all of what it took to put this on, because I think the people who put that production on should be commended, because it takes an extraordinary amount of time to, you know, you really do have the, when they're riffing or when they're like doing certain jokes, is you have to time that particular joke with, you know, the time frame or the time stamp of the movie, like what scene is playing, what shot are we looking at. I know one reoccurring thing is whenever Janet had her mouth open, they had this big penis, the shadow of this big penis put in her mouth.
they put it in the corner of the screen
when she looked interested in a particular direction.
And then they said penis at 7 o'clock, and then she turned and she was like, that got her attention, and just like stuff like that.
I mean, and they did call her a slut like every 5 minutes.
Yeah. Like they gave Brad and Janet nicknames. They gave Janet the nickname of slut. And they nicknamed Brad asshole, which fits their kind of demeanors, I guess.
Also, I mean, there was just so many up to date material that I really adored. I know, like, it kind of reminded me of how, and it's so weird that I'm comparing this to Disney. But it kind of reminded me of what they did at DCA, the Disney California Adventure Park, with their production of Aladdin, which had the genie, and the genie was like the star of the production, and he had like up-to-date material to use for the new, which made the show really stay up-to-date in its like 14-year run.
Wouldn't it have been great to see Aladdin in the Trump administration?
Well, I mean, we got a little taste of that here. There was a lot of Trump done. I mean, I think there was a point where Donald Trump must die, Donald Trump must die. They were chanting. There was this thing about Nazis came up, and then someone said, actually, they prefer to be called the alt-right.
Yeah. And then I like the joke where you have Dr. Frankfurter he's dead in the water.
Oh my god. They
yelled out, "Meanwhile in Puerto Rico."
That killed me. And it's so fucked up because people are you know, there's so many people in Puerto Rico without power, but I mean, that's a pretty accurate description, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so fucked up.
And other jokes are really funny too. I like it's crass. It's dirty. But I loved it. When after this long-winded performance that Tim Curry puts on, they're like, "What do we give this performance? A 6.9? What's a 6.9? Oh. It's a 69 ruined by a period." Just stuff like that was amazing, and
that was great.
I really love, because about 70 to 85% of this, the riffing is scripted. You know that, right?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it kind of has to be scripted. I mean, with the pace that they're going with the movie, it needs to be for the most part. I thought it was all scripted. I mean,
Once in a while they go off book, but that's on a rare occasion.
Like Donald Trump in a campaign rally.
Yeah. So anything else, Alexis?
That was a hell of a day, I'll tell you that. I think I had a lot of fun that day.
Would you recommend the Rocky Horror Picture Show to anybody?
Ooh. Or
just to a certain select few who would appreciate it.
If you're daring enough and willing to put up with some things that you might not find flattering, like if you want to see the movie on its own, just do that, and be prepared for a lot of interruptions, a lot of loudness, a lot of crassness, phallic material even. But, like, if you don't give a shit and you want a good time, this is a good time.
Yeah, it's a great time. According to Crazed Imaginations, which is the organization in San Diego that does this thing, go watch it at the Ken Theater. Because they're more lenient on the jokes, and you definitely see a lot of skin. That's another thing about if you were to ever see it. You definitely see a lot of skin, and they were allowed to at that specific theater. So go if you're in the San Diego area, and that's going on, go watch it in the Kent Theater. It's in Kensington near Hellcrest. Go watch it there. I know that they do one in Encinitas or something like that. They're far a little more leaning on the conservative side there, so they're not allowed to like show skin and stuff like that. But if you want the full Monty, go see it in the Kent Theater, or find out which districts allow your kind of preferences kind of thing. Final thoughts, Alexis?
That was it.
That was it?
Well, my final thoughts is this is a really entertaining movie. Go see it. And yeah, I had a good time with it. And before we go, I do want to promote our next To the Table, our Chaplin Hour.
Yes, it's pretty much a Chaplin themed To the Table, with you having me watch one of his works, Modern Times,
right?
Which I had no idea existed, and I'm having you watch the Robert Downey Jr. movie Chaplin, which is a pretty great movie I've also been championing for you to see it for a long time. So yeah, we're gonna watch Modern Times. I remember seeing a couple of Chaplin movies, like I saw The Kid. I saw The Kid and The Great Dictator and stuff like that. And those are really good. Those are two good movies about him. And I can't wait to see Modern Times. Can't you wait to see Chaplin?
Yeah, no, I can't wait. That'll be, I think, next week or something. It's going to be a fun show. I do want to, just for those who do not know, Modern Times is a silent movie. For the most part. One of the last major silent films in Hollywood. So that's something brand new that we're going to be a new kind of movie. I don't think we've ever covered a silent film on To the Table before.
No, we have not. And I think it'll be the only time. unless I have you watch Trip to the Moon.
I've already seen Trip to the Moon.
Oh, really?
Yes, I have a film class, and yeah, I've already saw Trip to the Moon. We can do it to the table about that later. I mean, yeah.
No, let's do it right. I want to discuss it right now. What'd you think about it?
What the hell?
Because it's one of my favorite pieces of cinema. I'm just, like, completely entranced by it. The hell is your reaction?
I mean, it's pretty innovative, I'll give you that. They have these bunch of old men, I think, and they form a contraption, and they go to the moon, right? Is that what they want? And they go to the moon, and then they get there, and it's like there's, oh my god.
Bunch of discoveries.
Yeah.
They're like these like creatures.
Yes.
They're not quite aliens.
Yeah.
But they're something.
Yeah.
I just love the ingenuity of the Trip to the Moon.
No, yeah. I thought it was great entertainment, and the class loved it very much. I thought what was most remarkable is in the class itself, there is this TA. And she usually brings her like 7 or 8 year old son to the class. And I think you can tell how great a film of any kind is, especially how old it is and for the type of black and white silent movie, one of the first movies ever made. And the kid.
Oh, you watched the black and white version?
I think it was the black and white version. Yeah. Yeah, it was the black and white version.
And because I saw the color version.
You know, I honestly, anyway, I can't recall. Okay, it could have been either or, but what I'm saying is the kid was laughing his ass off, so he was wildly entertained. I think that was pretty nice to see a 7-8 year old in 2018 enjoy a movie from an era that has largely been gone for quite some time.
Yeah. And a great moment in cinema, because that was the beginning of it all. What entranced me was the color version, and that was the reason why it was in color was because they took each an individual reel, and individual vector, and they colored it in frame by frame.
Which I mean that has to suck.
It's a 15-minute movie, but
movies weren't long back then. I mean, that was, I think, cutting it. That was
feature length back then.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And so them coloring the filmmakers coloring in reel by reel, frame by frame, was really interesting, and I really enjoyed that kind of aspect to it. Plus, you have the famous image of the moon and the contraption getting lodged in the moon's eye, and that's always the bonus to see, and it's great. So yeah, go check out To the Moon also, guys. You could say that about all the movies that we put out and we talk about and discuss. So just watch more movies. That's the whole thing. And that's the thing that we're trying to encourage here on To the Table.
And it's also very exciting to branch out into new kinds of movies.
Yeah. And if you like To the Table, you could check it out on podcast.com if you're Android user or And if you're an Apple user, go to iTunes.com, and the podcast will be there too. Also, our other podcasts, Respawn Entertainment and Fantasy Fair, come out on both of those sites. And if you want to see our bright and shiny faces, check out YouTube, where we do our After Darks, where we vlog our reaction to a movie we just saw.
Or if you are in the area, I live in the La Jolla area. I live on the UC San Diego campus, where I currently am employed by Starbucks, which, by the way, I should recommend our brand new Blonde Espresso promotion. It's a more caffeinated espresso shot with a tinge of a sweetness, a citrus flavor sweetness to it. Right now, at no extra charge, I will tell you that the new Blonde Espresso at Starbucks. And what is a podcast if it isn't Alexis promoting something?
Yes.
At least you can say it wasn't Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Which, by the way,
you can catch every single Friday at 9 on ABC, except for February, because they're going on hiatus until March 2nd. So that's something.
Red Spotters, I bid you farewell.